How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Chatter on Books. So many things to cover. These are all my little pop-ups I'm showing people watching News Channel 8. We won't have time for all of them. But we've got a terrific show this evening. We have the award-winning, best-selling author, Eric Blehm, who has The Darkest White, which is a mountain legend and the avalanche that took him, about Craig Kelly, this guy, honestly, I had never heard of before. But the reason you have a snowboarding industry has a lot to do with this guy and his life. Incredible, incredible book. But first, we have Claude Jennings doing all the important work. And we have our favorite mayor of Chatter on Books and beyond, and favorite book festival founder, important person of all things, Judd Ashman. Claude, great to see you. Judd, welcome back.
Thank you.
Great to be back. And it's great to see Mayor Judd. We love Mayor Judd.
Man. We love Mayor Judd.
Our guy. It is mutual.
cannot start any conversation today, which is we're taping this on Monday at a little bit after 6 p.m. East Coast, the eclipse. Judd, did you experience it?
Well, I was out and about. But I have to admit, I'm sorry, I'm going to come across as a terrible wet blanket here, but I'm not the biggest eclipse guy. Like, I took the opportunity. I went to the gym. The gym was not packed at the moment. I saw enough pictures. I've been through eclipses before. It's just, I'm not that guy.
Okay, Claude, moving on, because I didn't like that answer, Claude.
No, so I thought that I was going to be like Mary Jane. I mean, for most of the days leading up to it, and even this morning, I'm like, you know, whatever. But I was home, and 11-year-old Manny was home. And so the doorbell rung, and our neighbor, sweet lady, came over, and she had extra eclipse glasses.
Nice.
And so, you know, my wife's outside, and they're looking through the thing, and I'm just hearing all this chatter through the window, and I'm like, I should go out there and kind of see what this is all about. And so the next thing you know, we're outside, it gets a little dark. We're looking up and we've got the glasses on and we're looking at it. I thought it was cool. I mean, you know, because and my son was all into it, my wife as well. And it was a nice little break in the day to look up. And I try to do the thing where you kind of look up and not stare at the sun and see if you can kind of see with your natural eyes. I don't recommend people do that. But only for a second. I just wanted to see.
Yeah.
So right now, nothing's wrong with my eyes, but we'll see what happens tomorrow.
I will say in my defense, the city of Gaithersburg had we have a latitude observatory, like a historical one in the city of Gaithersburg. Uh-huh. And we had a couple thousand people out there. We supplied all the glasses and stuff.
Nice.
So we supported it.
So 20 years from now, when you're still mayor, because you'll be mayor for life, you can invite us all back. Okay, so I wasn't really paying attention until this past weekend. And then, as everybody knows, I love shared experiences. And it's like, I love shared experience. I want to understand more about this. And I'm bopping around this weekend with my daughter, who very nicely spent the weekend with me, and I'm 20-something. And I said, I just, you know, like many things, I flunked astronomy. I don't get it. So she'd be trying to show me on a cocktail napkin, wherever we're sitting in a bar, shockingly sitting in a bar. And it wasn't working for me. And you know, in bars, when you have the pretentious bowl full of the limes and the lemons and the stuff for the bartender, she starts borrowing some of those. And starts demonstrating, you know, like the orange is the sun and the lime goes around the lemon. And so then it starts to make more sense. But I'm in D.C. today and it was so much fun because at about 2:30 or 3, first of all, weird things started happening. One of our dogs, who's 10,000 years old, said, I'm going in the closet. Not really sure why, but he went in the closet. The other one just got very sad and morose. But I went across the street to a park, a bunch of people gathering, which is just kind of cool. Random people you don't normally see. And we all had our little glasses. The temperature dropped.
Oh, dramatically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dramatically. And the light did change. Here near the DMV, we were 87-88%, I guess, eclipse.
Yeah.
So it didn't get dark per se, but it was different.
Yes. The light was different, noticeably.
Yeah. I loved it.
A lot of the experts did say you got to watch your pets because, and we did hear a lot of dogs barking and howling and stuff. Now, what's interesting, I do wish we were in the path of totality. That would have been kind of cool for it to get like kind of, you know, totally dark. But it was fun. It was good. And people were outside in my neighborhood. I mean, and even one of the neighbors was getting some work done to her floors. And, you know, the guys who were working on the floors had glasses. What? And they came outside and took a break to look at it.
When's the last time people just had reasons to just go out inside and stand together and watch something, even for 15 minutes?
Right. And it wasn't like because of COVID, you could only talk to people outside, you know, distance and stuff. Yeah.
I love that. Okay, a few shout outs. Rob Dundon, TK loyal listener, really good fan and friend of the show, wonderful guy who, among his many responsibilities, raises money for Alzheimer's research and in honor of his mother, Kathy. And he does wonderful things to raise money, including we Chatter plays a very small part. He asks people to make contributions to the Alzheimer's Foundation, and if they do, then they get a book signed by a Chatter on Books author. So small role for us. Happy to do it. Rob very nicely sent a very nice thank you note recently, and a $100 gift card to Calvert Woodley,
Oh, check
our
that out.
official non-official favorite wine and liquor store in Washington, D.C. So Rob, thank you. Okay, then this one, my friend Jake. So, Claude, do you remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about all the angsty books about boys at boarding school?
Sure.
We're like, what's up with this? Why are there so many famous books and then they become movies about boys at boarding school? And we all had stupid theories. So I get a text from my friend. I'll use their names. My friend Janelle, wonderful person. Her son Jake, whom I adore. And she goes, oh my God, I'm so happy. Nah. We were listening to your recent podcast on the way home from their on college tours. And you were talking about why books were getting written about prep school kids, Catcher in the Rye, et cetera. Jake said, I just read about this in AP US History, and these books were written as post-war books because of teenage angst. How fantastic is that?
Okay, nice.
Great job, Jake. And I just love that they're actually teaching something like that in AP History, which is fantastic.
Well done, Jake.
Well done, Jake. Right? I mean, really great kid, smart kid, fantastic tennis player, bound for NIL sponsorship by Chatter on Books.
Nice.
Okay. I was in a great independent bookstore this weekend in Middleburg called Middleburg Books. Dragged my daughter in right before she did the astronomy lesson. And in bookstores, we talked a couple of weeks ago about when I go into airport newsstands and I love seeing books on the shelves from Chatter authors. So Middleburg Bookstore, which is lovely, Middleburg Books, and people should go. Angie Kim, Liza Mundy, Nane Kwame Adjei-Brenya, Chain Gang All-Stars, fantastic book. Eric Larson and a few others. So we're just crushing.
All of those, by the way, except for Eric Larson, that are alumni of the Gaithersburg Book Festival.
Yes, we're going to get to the Gaithersburg Book Festival because there are a bunch of Chatter on Books alum there, which is fantastic. Okay, we're going to skip funniest novel since Catch 22.
Oh, man.
Okay, what did you think of that list? I thought it sucked. I said it
Okay,
sucked.
so you're
What?
talking about the New York Times did this list of just for fun,
Yeah.
the 22 funniest novels since Catch 22. And they
Catch 22.
actually,
And it was a great setup and it was an angsty selection. There are plenty of things I like about the New York Times, but they get very angsty about stuff like this. But did you agree with
Well,
some?
I mean, I'd only read two on the list, Portnoy's Complaint and Heartburn, and I thought both deserved to be on the list. Portnoy's Complaint was hilarious.
Yeah, agreed.
And for well, it's maybe it's a little dated now. I don't know how it holds up, but I remember laughing out loud a lot. But
Yep.
I feel like they limited themselves to what we would call literary fiction, and they ruled out stuff like anything by Dave Barry or Carl Hiaasen, is as funny as anything on their list.
Yeah, I agree.
And Confederacy of Dunces and Princess Bride and
Lovely.
Breakfast of Champions are none of those are on the list, and I think they all could be.
Ball four.
I didn't
Ball
read
four.
all four.
Oh, fantastic. It's sort of a whole genre of books. I had read the two you talked about, and then American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis, also very, very funny. But the rest of them, Bridget Jones' Diary, did that. Probably watched the movie and then read the book. Just that's tragic, but I did that. I just thought it was such a great setup, and I was really looking forward to it. And then I kind of went, oh, come on. But
They could have
then
done better.
it cost me, I lost my copy 1,000 years ago, but I have ordered Catch 22 to read that one again. Fantastic.
I
Okay.
tried a few years ago. I didn't feel like it held up that well.
Really?
Eric is here. Eric, have you read Catch 22?
A long time ago.
Do you remember finding it hilarious?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I read so much nonfiction that I'm not the novel guy though. I'm just not.
Yeah, understood.
I thought it was a whole new way of writing. Not that I know these phrases and terms, because this is the most non-literary book podcast out there. But I remember at the time thinking, oh, nobody writes like this, which is why I liked it. Okay, Mayor Judd Ashman, you ready to talk about the Gaithersburg Book Festival?
Yes, I am ready.
Okay. Loyal listeners remember a lot about it, but remind us of the history, how it's the biggest, the best, et cetera. And I want to talk about some of the chatter on books. No, it's pretty great. It really is. But I want to talk some of our authors that are going to be on there. But you first, history, how it got started.
I have all that. I have a list of the Chatter on Books alumni that are going to be there too. But I'll let you do that if you want.
Okay, definitely.
So Gaithersburg Book Festival is now, this is our 15th year.
It's amazing.
We bring in, we're like a typical book festival in which we bring in authors to come speak about their latest books and sign books. And we have workshops for aspiring writers, and we have all kinds of kids activities, and it's an amazing thing. What sort of sets us apart in this area, which is, I'm in Gaithersburg, about 25 minutes northwest of Washington, D.C. We are the largest, right now we're the largest book festival in the state of Maryland. And we're the largest outdoor book festival in the DMV. So we have those things going for us. The book festival is coming up. Our 15th book festival is coming up on Saturday, May 18th. It is free to attend and free to park. You cannot say anything is free to park in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
So,
Easy to get to off the beltway, off 270 for those of you coming to the DMV. Easy to get to. And the parking is easy.
the parking is easy, and it's even easier this year. And before we get into the authors, I just want to say if you want to find out more about the Gaithersburg Book Festival, go to gaithersburgbookfestival.org. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're all over that. So we have tons of great authors. Tori, you want to talk about the ones you're
Yeah.
excited about?
Well, I just want to talk about what surprised me the first time we came out there. And it's so fantastic is everybody's been to book festival, you kind of get it, but there are so many activities. There are activities for kids, there are activities for adults. I forget the name of it, but it's a covered space where there are used books for sale. And you kind of think, because I'm constantly giving away books, but there were dozens of people lined up pouring over those books and buying them, which was fantastic. It was the diversity of activities, which I thought was fantastic. And so, whatever your interest is, whatever your age is, there is something there for you, which I thought was terrific. And
Yeah.
the enthusiasm of the authors when they're there, there's something about the environment. It's very relaxed, it's very fun. They really enjoy being there, except when it's 110 degrees.
Which happened 2 years ago.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense that the third Saturday of May in any year should be the hottest day of the year, but that was the case 2 years ago. But Tori, you're right. The used book sale is done by the Friends of the Library, so it's a big
Wow.
fundraiser for the library system. And then we have our bookseller partner, Politics and Prose, is selling the featured authors' books that you can go and buy and get signed that day.
Yep.
So tremendous lineup. We usually get about 130, 140 authors. It's a one-day thing, so it's very densely packed. There's 10 or 12 different pavilions where there's an author speaking at a pavilion at any given time. And it's for all ages and all
It really
tastes.
is. Okay, I'm just going to tick off some of the, and if I miss some, let me know, Judd. The
Sure.
people, the Chatter on Books authors, because once they've been on the show, they're ours. Ed Amar, who we love, book noir, as I call him. Susan Cole, Ann Foster, and that's when David and I, and hopefully Claude will be there doing a special Chatter on Books edition at the festival with Ann Foster, who has a spectacular book, The Long War on Drugs. Angie Kim, who's just phenomenal and
That was
showing.
one of the biggest books of the year,
Oh,
Happiness Falls.
Happiness Falls, so fantastic. Someday we're going to be saying we knew her when,
No doubt.
and she won't return our phone calls.
Yeah,
Liza Mundy, great. Susan Page, who's going to be on this show in a couple of weeks, epic, absolutely epic. Great book coming out on Barbara Walters, fantastic. Two that we want, Judd, and maybe we can trade bribes. Clint Smith and James Swanson.
I'm sure we can make that happen. They're
Okay.
both local, actually.
I know. And James Swanson, Manhunt, great book. This, of course,
Oh
being
my God.
made. Yeah, great
Such
book.
a great book.
Okay. All right.
Two others that you that hasn't Stephanie Dre been on Chatter on Books before? Historical fiction.
I hope not, because I'm not remembering her, which
Okay. I don't mean to do that to you. And you've had Karen Tanabe on
yes.
before.
Oh, she's fantastic.
She's moderating a panel for us too.
Okay,
Uh,
she's
but
fantastic.
some of the others that are notable that will be there this year, it you may remember Barack Obama's inaugural poet, Richard Blanco.
Oh, yeah.
Coming with a new collection of poetry. On the literary side, we have Alice McDermott, National Book Award winner. Her new novel is, I think it's my favorite of her books. On the political side, McKay Coppins, who's got a book called Romney. A Reckoning. McKay Coppins is a staff writer for The Atlantic. It's a terrific book. On the historical side, Harold Holzer is one of the foremost Lincoln scholars, with a book called Brought Forth on This Continent: Abraham Lincoln and American Immigration. On the sports side, I'm sure David would know Joe Posnanski. His book is Why We Love Baseball: A History in 50 Moments. We have from the New York Times, Nick Kristof, the columnist. He's got a memoir of his reporting life. And we have humor, A.J. Jacobs, The Year of Living Constitutionally. This guy had a memoir a few years ago called The Year of Living Biblically, where he
That's
spends a year and he tries to live by exactly the way the Bible says. So he's a funny
right.
guy. On the philosophical side, I just read this book, Travis Reeder, who's the head of the bioethics program at Johns Hopkins University, which is a pretty big deal,
Pretty
right?
interesting topic, yeah.
Yeah, his book is called Catastrophe Ethics: How to Choose Well in a World of Tough Choices. And he makes philosophy as accessible as it could be made in this, but it is dense, but it's really smart. It's a really good book. And all kinds, Clint Smith, who's an
Instrument is
amazing
great.
author and poet, and a lot, like 100 others that I'm not
Yeah.
going to get into.
And I'm not deep in it yet, but Judd is doing a superhuman effort to get a lot of us into poetry. Not yet, but we'll dabble in it a little bit. But no, and I know the agenda. I'm not there looking at the schedule. I know who's going where and who's under which tense. There are a lot of poetry fans out there, so God bless you for meeting that need, Judd.
Thank you. Thank you. We actually just had a poet, April is Poetry Month, and we just had a poetry event
Right.
last Thursday. It was great.
And I'm shockingly, my schedule did not accommodate that, but I heard it pretty well. Okay. Should we talk to Eric?
Let's talk to Eric.
Eric, you still with us?
I'm right here.
Excellent. Eric Blem, thank you so much for joining Chatter. Great to see you. Great to meet you. Thanks for joining.
Likewise, likewise. Thank you.
Thank you for writing this unbelievable book. There are so many reasons this would not be up my alley, but I had read a few things about it and I thought, okay, I want to learn more about this. And so I learned more about it and learned more about you. Riveting does not begin to describe The Darkest White.
Thank you.
Riveting. And I mean, I'll just blather. I'm going to make sure Claude and Judd get to ask lots of questions. But there are just some things I'm just like, I'm not really that interested in the history of the snowboarding industry. But the way you talk about it and the characters involved, you go, oh my God, this is absolutely fascinating. So spectacular. And we will get deep into The Darkest White, which is a terrible pun when you think about it. But here at Chatter, we love the backstory. So we want your backstory, because among other things, you're kind of an accomplished person on the snow yourself. But where are you from? Where'd you grow up? What'd you want to be when you were five? Did you ever think
Well,
you're going to be writing this kind of book?
it would have been a dream. When I was 17, my mom passed away from cancer after a 4-year battle with cancer. I grew up in San Diego, North County, not exactly a snow capital of the
Oh.
country, right? And but I had a friend who introduced me to snowboarding in the early 80s. His name was Carlos, and we were best buddies. And he was a guy that could put a Rubik's Cube together in like 0.3 seconds. He always was on to the next new thing. And we fell in love with snowboarding. My mom passed away from cancer, and I was always kind of escaping into books and or magazines at that era, like surfing, BMX, and then snowboarding magazines. And my ultimate dream was to be a professional snowboarder in the mid-80s, before anyone, before half the snowboard or ski areas in the country even allowed snowboarding.
Before
And
people
then,
knew of it, right?
exactly. And by a chance, one of the last things my mom told me before she passed was, if there's anything you want to do in life, do it now, because you never know about tomorrow. And after I graduated high school in a year of junior college, I wanted to move to Breckenridge, Colorado, and try and become a professional snowboarder. And I'll do every book and podcast has to have a montage. So I met a travel writer on a chairlift who was asking me all sorts of questions and about being in Breckenridge, because I had a season pass around my neck. And by the end of the conversation, I turned it around and asked him, "Hey, what did you major in college? Did you go to college?" And I said, "You got free lift tickets for a week. They put you up in this swanky lodge. You're in the jacuzzi at night. You're asking where the best happy hours are. What did you major in?" And he said, "Journalism." And so I blew my knee out a little bit later, realized that I wasn't going to be Craig Kelly, who is the protagonist of my book, like the Shaun White of my era.
Yeah.
And I decided I'm going to go back to school, get a degree in journalism, and write for a snowboarding magazine and see the world on someone else's dime. And
wow. Okay.
That was
commercial break.
What I did.
Eric,
yeah.
We often come up with random ideas for books. We're always David Aldridge, who, by the way, sends his apologies. He got screwed up on a transportation issue, which is not why he's not with us tonight. But we're always coming up with ideas for books David should write. But here's one somebody should write. Over the decades, I've heard more stories. Somebody meets somebody on a chairlift, not a big skier, you know, dabbled in it for the sake of our kids. But there are these great stories. It's not, oh, well, yeah, I met him on a chairlift and I thought about X, Y, or Z. Whatever. You could do a whole book on that alone.
Oh my gosh. Well, listen, I'm gonna lay my claim to this one right now. My daughter says I need to find that person, and she wants to, and she told me I should call it Finding My Inspiration, because somewhere out there this guy wrote a story about Breckenridge, Colorado in that year. I could probably find it somewhere, but he was a travel writer, and I recall he was from Texas. And anyway, it would be kind of a fun thing to find this person who ultimately planted that seed of journalism. And I always loved stories. I mean, the first book that made me want to be a writer was Swiss Family Robinson.
Nice.
My mom read, you know, at a young age, that idea of adventure. And, you know, even though it's ridiculous that every single, you know, animal that could be on any continent in the world ended up on this island, like penguins slash lions slash whatever.
There was an eclipse and they all ended up there.
Exactly.
Make it topical. That's great.
Exactly.
But it was just awesome. Yeah. Hey, wow. Boom. Shabam. That was a good one.
Okay. Your daughter's brilliant. You could find that person.
Yeah. So that would be kind of a fun thing, right? To find this person who gave me planted that seed. And yeah, ultimately I did. I worked for a snowboarding magazine and I got to travel the world snowboarding, riding powder with my heroes that I had escaped into this weird world of snowboarding, of shredders, back when my mom was laying in the hospital for many years fighting cancer. And it was kind of became a dream, honestly. It was kind of a way to see the world. I mean, I got to go, my first trip to Europe was flying into Venice and getting a like old school polished wood motorboat to a hotel with three pros. And then we were whisked up into the Dolomites and I went to Cortina. And that was my first time in Europe, you know, with pro snowboarders lugging around snowboard bags. And I've ridden in Iran, in New Zealand, Australia, all over Europe, BC, Canada, helicopters, snowcats, whatever. It was awesome. It was amazing.
So, okay, before we get on to how good you must have been to keep up with the people you were covering, first, then Judd. Any desire whatsoever, extreme sports in general, snow in particular? Claude first.
So the interesting thing is I went skiing once and I couldn't get off the lift. Every time I'm up, I can't get off the lift without falling down. And then it takes me so long to get down, you know, the slopes, because I'm falling every 5 or 6 seconds. And so while I want to do it because it looks really cool, I know I'll be horrible at it and I'll probably hurt myself. And so for my own safety, I wish I could. I do have the desire. I just know I don't have the ability.
I think part of it is if you're from the DMV, I've been here for long enough, Eric, that I'm from the DMV. Claude, born and raised. Judd, snowboard, extreme sports in general, snow in particular. Any interest?
Well, first 25 years of my life were in Miami, Florida.
Oh, right.
Okay. There was no snow.
Yeah.
I did some extreme, I water skied before, I jet skied, but I did not mountain ski until I got up here, and I was not good at it. And that it was my life as a skier was very, very brief.
Yeah. Yeah. Years ago, we tried for our kids, for the sake of our kids, we get them out a lot. And around here, Eric, you go to Whitetail, like, you know, an hour away.
Yeah.
And then occasionally we go out somewhere real or whatever. And like the 95th time in, there's so much equipment. I turned to my husband. I said, you know what? I love everything about skiing. I love the locations. I love being outdoors. I love the accoutrement. I love the après ski. I love all of it except the skiing.
And all the gear,
putting
ski boots on a child, at a young child is I will say, take a lesson, because is the most important thing. And other than that, you know,
let's talk about your blown out knee. So you, to keep up with, and this is an important part of the book, because you write the book, The Darkest White, because you write with real knowledge. You had to have been pretty good to keep up with these people that you were covering when the industry was growing and these icons like Craig Kelly, who we'll talk about, but you had to have been pretty good, right?
I, you know what, I could keep up with the pros that I got to follow, and sometimes by default, I mean just because I had to, you have to, and you get better when you hang out with people who are better than you. But before the magazine and all that, I did end up getting sponsored. I was a competitive snowboarder for a couple years, and I mean I was a ski bum for a year in Breckenridge. I rode, got to snowboard 120 days in one season was what I did. I know it was 120 days because my boss at Main Street Sports in Breckenridge said everybody always argues who got the most days in at the end of the year, and he gave told me every time you go out make a notch on this broomstick, and so that's what I did. At the end of the year, I got to about 115, and I went 5 more days because I wanted around 120.
Nice. Okay, we talked about this a couple weeks ago because of all of NIL now, name, image, likeness. Say you were in college, your college age, and you were an athlete in the sport. If you could only pick one sponsor, who would your sponsor be?
Oh, at that era, it would have, when I was in college, it would have been Burton. It would have been Burton snowboards. I mean, because they were the most, they were independent. They were, they had their blank together. You know, they had their stuff together. They knew what was up, and they were at the tip of the spear as far as equipment. You know, you could always, if you could pick one brand where you could go and grab a board, bindings and boots off the shelf, and every one of them is going to work and work well. Burton Snowboards was it.
Okay, 2024, there's a seniors tour. It's an advanced seniors tour, and you get to re-enlist. Who would your sponsor be today?
Oh man, there are several that are really, really good. Currently, I still support and ride Burton boards. I also love Jones. Jeremy Jones came out with his own brand. An old school brand called Winterstick has some really good boards as well. Gnu, Libtech, there's quite a few, but the ones that I would pick have all been around, honestly, since the beginning.
That's interesting. That's a good sign. Okay, should we talk about your fabulous book, The Darkest White?
You
Because
know
it's
what?
fantastic.
I love it. I don't know if you saw it. Actually, it was in the New York Times Book Review this weekend. Just came out.
Holding up for
How
people on News Channel 8, New York Times.
crazy.
How crazy is that? Written by Simon Winchester, who has been on this show. What a great guy. Oh my God, Claude, I don't remember this, but it was during the pandemic. He had a fabulous book called Land. And
Oh, yeah.
you think you don't care about what this was about, which is like the meaning of an acre. It's spectacular, but I can't remember the name of it, but it was height of the pandemic, and his son-in-law or somebody had invented a specialty COVID cocktail. And so maybe the first 20 minutes of when Simon was on, we were talking about the specialty cocktail, which involved getting snow from outside.
He is a
Perfect.
terrific writer.
He is a terrific writer.
No, the when I found out that he when I saw that it was his name on it, first of all, I thought, oh, it's a fellow writer at least, because you never know what you're going to get. And the second thing was Simon Winchester, and I thought, Professor and the Madman, right, is
Yes, I read
one of
that
the
was a
books.
great book.
And I thought, oh my gosh, I just loved it. And I believe the remake, the movie was pretty awesome as well, I believe. But if there was a movie, I'm pretty sure there was. But the book, I read it twice. I mean, there's not too many books I read twice.
And he's just a spectacular writer. And when I saw that he had done the review, I thought, again, good. I mean, the New York Times book review on can drive me crazy because it's very angsty. It can get very pretentious. But I thought whoever picked him to write the review of your book was really smart because there are complexities in the book, and you don't want just the standard idiot doing the review. So somebody
Totally.
picked really, really well, and it was a
And
real.
the first that first paragraph too, what you said, who could ask for a better first paragraph, because he explains exactly what you said. It's not a book for snowboarders, it's a book for everybody.
So that's a nice tea. I'm gonna say it, and then you can introduce us to Craig Kelly.
If I can interrupt 1 second, or so, the book was called Land: How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World.
There you go. Thank you, Claude. It
Thank
was
you.
he was fabulous. He was one of the
Beautiful.
all-time great guests. Okay, this is the first graph of Simon's review of Eric's book. I have no shame in admitting to neither a scintilla of knowledge of nor any potential ability in the wildly popular sport of snowboarding. So the unfamiliar jargon and the curious cast of characters in Eric Blehm's latest outdoor true adventure story passed right over my head. Second graph, and yet this is probably the most unremittingly exciting book of nonfiction I've come across in years. That's a mic drop
Wow.
moment.
Yes, it
I know.
is.
I know. I mean, I got to say, to hear that in the New York Times from Simon Winchester is just, it's like, thank you. Thank you for getting it, Simon Winchester.
And the subhead under Snowfall, which is the head of Simon's review. Eric Blum chronicles the 2003 disaster that killed the pioneering snowboarder Craig Kelly and six others. So there's, you know, there's no spoiler alerts here, but introduce us to Craig Kelly, Eric, because he is, you know, those of us, as you've now learned, spend very little time on the snow. I'm sure Judd and Claude share my kind of stereotypical whatever of snowboarders. Crazy, yeah. Color outside the lines, don't play by the rules. Craig Kelly was not your typical snowboarder, correct?
No, not at all. He was the Michael Jordan, let's say, of snowboarding as far as the sport goes at that time. He was that big in our world. If you were a snowboarder in the mid 80s into the 90s, you knew who Craig Kelly was at that level. Yeah. I would tell people that if you walked up, well, the reason to back up just a tiny bit, when I decided to write this book, I mean, imagine, he's my hero. I wrote his obituary when he passed away. I got to know him as a friend, as an editor for the world's biggest snowboarding magazine. And when he passed away, it was just this heart-stopping moment, like our universe had lost a void. There was a black hole that just gobbled up our hero. And I was in a lift line in 2018, 15 years after Craig had passed away. And I had, and a lot of us had, stickers that were made that said, "Craig Kelly is my co-pilot," after he passed away, kind of a homage to the man. And this 20 something year old kid in line next to me looks down at my board and just looks over at me and says, "Who's Craig Kelly?"
Oh.
And to me, it would be like walking up to a pickup game somewhere with a half court somewhere wearing a Michael Jordan jersey and someone saying, "Who's Michael Jordan?" I mean, that is exactly what it felt like to me. It went straight to my heart. And that was what made me go back home to my storage unit, dig into the boxes. And I found my box, an old legal box that had just one word written on it. It said Craig. And it had all my old articles I'd written and gone on trips with him, the obituaries, the coroner's report, and investigation into the avalanche and his death. And that's when I decided I've got to, you know, tell this story to the current generation. And also just because he is such a crazy, interesting character. He was a latchkey kid in the 80s. He was like one of the kids on ET, you know, always cruising around on his BMX bike, hitting jumps, soaring airs, getting into trouble. And then he was also very smart, cerebral. He graduated high school at 17 and got a year early and got his chemical engineering almost degree at the University of Washington. Tested out of all of his first year freshman level college English, math, and science. So he started as a 17 year old at the sophomore level in college. And then he left it all behind.
and back up a little bit. You know, latchkey kid. Okay, that means a lot of things to a lot of people. I'm the youngest of five girls. But I was like the epitome of latchkey kid because my mother was exhausted. She was down the street drinking white wine with her friends. And God bless her for doing that, right? But parents got divorced when he was relatively young.
Yep.
They split up. And mom took his younger sister. Dad took him and his younger brother. But that didn't always stay the way it was. And dad was gone a lot. Not
a
for
lot.
Hours, but for days and weeks sometimes.
When he was like 14 years old, I think it was, or 15, he left. He was a mover, had a moving company, and he took a job that put him on the road for 3 weeks. And Craig was alone for 3 weeks as a kid, getting himself to school, Pacific Northwest, riding to school in the pouring rain on his BMX bike, and still got straight A's.
And getting a line of credit with the bank when he was 16?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was 16 years old. He came time for his birthday. He'd saved up enough money. His mom helped him get into a really cheap, inexpensive car, but he needed a little bit more, and he got a line of credit. And his buddies are all like, "Oh my God, how'd you do this?" And he said, "Well, yeah, I said I saved up for it. Plus, I'm establishing my credit with the bank." And his buddies would just say, "Bionically smart. Who thinks of that at 16?"
Exactly. Okay, let's ask Judd first, then Claude. Judd, 16, lines of credit. Did you even know what they were?
No. And my father was a banker, and I didn't. I had no clue.
Perfect.
Cobbler's kid had no shoes. Claude?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I just grew up being afraid of credit cards. My mom was like, "You don't want to get in credit card debt." She screamed all that stuff. So no, not at all.
When I was 16, okay, so worked in a barn, blah, blah. Thursday afternoons at school, I allegedly went to high school. My grades would not prove that. Thursday afternoon was focused on, holy cow, it's Thursday afternoon. We don't know where the party is on Friday night. So that was my mission, you know, for Friday night. And then my financing capabilities were all centered around, have we gathered enough money to buy a keg of Iron City Light beer? No, this guy was profoundly, brilliantly smart, and there are plenty of smart people, but he also was so organized, Eric, and so
Yeah.
purposeful. And he did all these wild, crazy, as I call it, coloring out the outside the lines things. But man, he knew what he was doing at a very
Yeah.
young age.
Yeah, he wanted, he decided he was had done a few of the early contests in snowboarding and knew he had skills, and but he realized that he was getting like second, third place with no training at all, and he decided, gosh, if I actually trained, I could maybe,
Yeah.
make some more, 'cause you were getting money, you're getting paid. And he added it all up. He looked it all up and thought, I'm going to graduate with a degree in chemical engineering. I could make this much money, or I could make a little bit less and snowboard around the world. And he thought, I'm going to take a chance and go for it. And by training, he kind of cobbled together his training regimens by looking at reading the biographies of baseball players and other athletes, skiers. Nothing, there was no roadmap for him. And he kind of created it himself on how to train as a snowboarder. And a lot of the snowboarders were, it was kind of like the bastard son of skiing, or the stepbrother of skating or surfing. So it was this hodgepodge of characters that were his influences. And
Yeah.
he just kind of put it all together in a way that worked for him. But he had discipline. That's the one thing he had. I think by growing up without a lot of money, as an independent kid who, if something was going to happen, you're going to make it happen yourself. That was what really drove him. And gosh, man, he drove himself all the way to four-time world champion in all sorts of aspects of the sport: half pipe, racing, moguls, obstacle courses, whatever they were dreaming up at the time that made people, that allowed the sport to have heroes. Because what do they want to do? They wanted to market them. I mean, all the people who own the companies wanted to market these kids that were
But
flashy.
they didn't initially. Initially,
No, no, not at all.
traditional world of sports and even the traditional world of snow sports kind of said, oh, come on, it's raging. It was interesting. I mean, this book is so fabulous, everybody. The Darkest White, there's so many things that come out. I mean, there were a couple of female athletes, unfortunately, I've forgotten their names, who were contemptuous of the Craig Kellys of the world and talked about the raging hormones of these young guys and these kind of things. It's like, how sexist is that? How
Yeah.
incredible. What female athlete would want to be criticized because of her hormones?
Oh
So
wow. Yeah, these were
I thought
ski the
that was.
skier, the skier. There was a Time magazine voted it the worst new sport in 1988. And
It was sexist in a way. But
totally.
there definitely would have been a snowboarding industry and it would have reached the peaks that it's reached. But it happened faster because of him, right? Because he knew how to negotiate a contract, because he knew about marketing, those kinds of things. He really
Yeah.
was the iconic force in the sport, right?
Yeah, and well, really the first true professional, because he did. He when he started finally getting contracts, he and another thing, he was very humble. I mean, there were other people ahead of him that did some of these things. A European named Jose Fernandez was
Yeah.
doing pretty well in Europe. Bert Lamar with a skateboarder that came into the scene. And that was another thing. Craig wasn't too smart to not realize there's people smarter than me.
Yeah.
And he would look, he had mentors. He considered a lot of his friends mentors. And he would consider, this is my mentor in real estate. This is my mentor as a racer. This is my mentor. And he could look at these people and what can they provide to me in the world? He was really, really good about looking past some of the negatives in people that a lot of people kink on, and trying to focus on the positive. And
Yeah.
even more so, he would spin it into positives because he would always want to emulate that. And again, this is a 20-year-old kid at that point. Who thinks like that?
Nobody thinks like that. And Claude, I want to ask you about this because when I was reading about him, and I thought, wow, now in the 21st century, there are some athletes who really know they are about much more than what they do on the court, on the field, on the ice, right? It's all these spokes that run out from a machine like that. He got that back then. He totally got that back then. But there aren't that many of them, right, Claude? I mean, Manny, Claude's son, who's going to be the first athlete Chatter on Book sponsors. You're thinking about all these spokes, aren't you, Claude? That it's not just about what Manny does on the golf course, it's about all these other things.
No, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, when you think about professional athletes, I mean, think about some of the things you see like LeBron James doing, right? I mean, he opened up that school in
Yeah.
Akron. He's got investments in entertainment and stuff like that. And even beyond his own career, I mean, even with basketball, he wants to get his son in the league and he wants to play a few years with his son. And so, yeah, I mean, they've got it all over the place. It reminds me almost kind of in a way. Do you remember when we had, I forget his name, but he wrote this book, Range, and talked about how everyone wants to specialize in one like thing. And that's not the best thing. Like you can't just, you know, there's a very small percentage of people who are great enough at one thing to specialize just in one thing. But even those people are great at having multiple things that they're good or excellent at. That makes sense.
Yeah. The Greek plate. Was it wasn't Dan Pink. Was it Epstein?
Epstein.
No,
yep.
Yes. Epstein. That's a great book. Okay. All right. Let's get into, again, there's no spoilers here. His love for Craig Kelly's love for just being on the snow really caused a career change almost, right, Eric? And
just
take us up to what happened and why it happened and the recrimination, which was kind of inevitable to it.
Are we talking about the Avalanche or him switching over to become free? Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, at one point he decided that, all the competition, he'd basically achieved every goal. You know, he'd been a world, after he'd been a world champion four times in a row, you know, he finally realized, you know, looking in the rearview mirror, there's other kids that are coming up behind me and they are going to surpass me. And he also loved, he looked back at what really drove him in the beginning, what made him fall in love with this sport. And it was just free riding, going up and riding the mountain, riding fresh snow, powder in particular. And so he thought, you know, let's make that a new goal for athletes to go free ride the whole mountain. And in doing so, you want to find fresh powder, and powder gets eaten up pretty quick where there's chairlifts and people can ski down. And so he started easing out away from the boundaries of the ski areas into the backcountry. And inevitably that's the wild snow, the uncontrolled snow, which unfortunately there are avalanches. And that was what he wanted to, at the end of his life, towards the end, he was learning how to be safer in the backcountry. He wanted to become a mountain guide and understand snow science, the people that predict avalanches and protect the highways, you know, all started in Europe. You know, Alta, Utah is a huge place here in the States, but that studying snow to understand when it's most likely to occur, to break down and flow down the mountain in an avalanche. And so he wanted to become a mountain guide at the end of his life. And in doing so as a snowboarder, most mountain guides were skiers once again. And so he had to first kind of break through those walls, just like we did originally with ski areas, to allow snowboarders on the slopes at ski areas. He had to do the same thing in that fraternity of mountain guides. And he had to basically show them that I can do everything you can do on a split board, which is a new type of snowboard that you can split down the center and basically walk up the mountains like a Nordic skier with climbing skins on the bottom of your skis for traction. And then once you get to the top, you can reconnect it together with these special clips. And then you are a snow surfer or snow skateboarder, whatever you want to call it, a snowboarder, and you can ride down sideways. And that was at the end of his life, kind of his, what he was working on with Burton Snowboards to really refine that particular type of piece of equipment and also learn about the mountain. And it's there is no exact science in snow science. It's always going to potentially be dangerous. And the year that he was going to be taking his exams and getting certified in this very prestigious Association of Canadian Mountain Guides, it was also a very dangerous winter for avalanches.
What made it a dangerous winter for avalanches?
That's something that is described in detail in the book, right? But basically snow falls, every storm is falls. When a storm fall, when the snow falls, each storm represents a layer, and they often use, or even his teacher would say, it's like a layered cake. And each storm will record the current temperatures and the wind and whatever might be going on at that time. And between each storm, those layers either bond together, like the frosting between a layer cake, or they tend to be more slippery and they can break down. And then if it's steep enough, come crashing down the mountain. And certain types of terrain, like a rollover in terrain, doesn't give you the support in the bottom of the hill that allows it to come down, versus a convex slope or concave slope is more supportive. So we learned all of this. That year there was a storm. It rained, which made like a sheet of ice. And then it snowed weeks later. And so there was a slick crust of ice between that and all these layers that came behind it, which made it even more tricky to maneuver and walk through the forest and the mountains, alpine, wherever. And so you had to choose your, instead of like, you couldn't really avoid the minefields, you had to like tiptoe around the minefields. And there's certain aspects of the snow that can break down. And you look at it like dominoes, really. Imagine if you have dominoes underneath two layers of snow, and in the right conditions, you disturb the dominoes and they break down all the way across underneath this layer of snow, which allows it to collapse. And when they collapse, it makes a really deep percussive whoomph. And then if you're on flat ground, that's no big deal. But imagine you're on a steep slope and it goes whoomph. And for a moment, you just wonder, okay, is that whole top layer going to slide? And that's what happened on one fateful day. And when he was on a very steep slope with 21 other skiers in with professional guides, and again, no spoiler alerts, but imagine you have learned how to avoid these avalanches. You're wearing transceivers that beep and transmit a beep, basically. So if you are buried, your others switch their transceivers to receive, and then you try and find those who are buried. Well, in this case, 13 people were buried, and there were seven left on top. And you have, seconds, if not, you have minutes to live, depending on the properties of the snow, and you have to find everybody.
One of the most extraordinary things in this book, everybody, and I read the book and then I listened to it, was 350 different interviews, Eric. Did I get that right? Over 300 with people.
350 hours of interviews, about
Hours of
120
interviews.
people.
Okay. Including and finding reports of people who have been trapped and what it's like and what's going through their minds and what's going through their lungs and their bodies at the time. Absolutely terrifying. And often we this show covers the range of books. And sometimes you'll be reading something you've never done before and go, oh, well, that'd be fun, right? Or some great basketball. You go, well, that'd be fun. I'd love to do that. Every page turning or listening to it in my car, I was like, no, never, ever, ever. Do not need to be there. Don't want to. Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. Was that hard to write? Especially when you knew the people involved and you knew Craig Kelly and he was a friend of yours. Was that hard to write knowing what they were going through in these final minutes?
Yeah, absolutely. And also knowing the people who are going to read it, his family members,
Yeah.
his widow, you have to be respectful of the people. But I also really wanted to explain those situations to, people who are there. So it's a cautionary story. People will think twice before they try, because everybody, you will push the limit, you'll push the envelope a little bit, you'll try and find that edge, and sometimes you're going to find
Yeah.
it. So I wanted it to be very real and very raw in that regard. So I mean, the book took me 5 years to research and write. And granted, there was COVID and a few other personal things going on during that period of time, but a long time. But I think part of the reason it took so long was I really didn't want to get to the end.
Yeah.
It's as I've written about heroes and my books on the military and whatnot before, and a lot of people will say they know what's coming, but they hope for a different ending. Well, that's kind of how I felt when I was writing and researching it.
It's totally how I felt reading it and listening to it. I went, oh no, we're going to go somewhere else with this. No, we were not. Okay, we got to switch to two things here in a minute. But Judd, thoughts, reactions? Is Eric lined up for next year at the Gettysburg Book Festival?
Oh, I'd love to have that at our book festival.
Awesome.
Snow. We'll bring in like big snow.
Your deal here, Eric, is that you can't tire of speaking about this book in the next
Yeah.
year.
Yeah.
So that's
No.
your job. That's your job.
I'll tell you.
Keep loving this book. But I wanted to circle back a little bit about avalanches. I had two questions actually. One's about avalanches, and I guess I'm wondering, this happened 20 years ago, or I forget what the year was, but it happened a while back. Have we gotten better at predicting avalanches when somebody goes and does backcountry snowboarding? Like, how do they assess the risk? Is it better today than it was then?
Great question.
Absolutely. It's better. It's also different. I mean, even at that time, they were on a cusp where like digging pits in the snow and doing these certain tests were really the kind of like the acid test for whether or not a slope was safe. But then right when this was going on, Craig, they were realizing that people were getting these false readings from these pits because it depended on how deep the snow was between the layer that they can stand on. Like, imagine you're standing on top of these dominoes with four sheets of plywood on top versus one, and one will flex and then it'll set off these dominoes. Well, that's the same thing with snow. Snow is variable depending on where you're walking. Windblown areas on the same storm, some will be only a foot of snow above that weak layer, and in other places it'll blow in 3 feet deep. Walking on 3 feet deep or three pieces of plywood is very stable. Walk on one piece and it flexes and sets off the avalanche. And so those are the type of metaphor that I try to do. So that's still tough. People look at it like, where, what are we going to use to try and discern that risk? So that has changed over time. I think that a big thing that has improved is communication. It once upon a time, you would look at like the one leader, the person with the most experience, and that is the, you know, it's my way or the highway type of a thing versus a collaborative effort. When you read this book, it's interesting how when I interviewed people, different people had their own, let's say, premonitions almost, but didn't say anything. The little EBGBs, you know, one person halfway up the slope decided, I'm not supposed to be here for no other reason than that, and started booking up the slope. Another person didn't even want to go on the slope, yet he never spoke up. And so I think stories like this help to kind of show that there are these, let's say, sixth senses out there that you do need to pay attention to, especially in the backcountry. But yeah, everything is always evolving and for the better. But again, it is nature and it is wild and it will win in the end. If you put yourself close to that edge enough times, eventually you're going to fall.
Fascinating. And like Tori, I not for me, not for me. So next question is about the different sort of branches of snowboarding. So I, you know, this isn't my world, but we all know Shaun White. How well does a competitive Olympic snowboarder skill set translate to this backcountry type of
Excellent.
snowboarding?
Well, it's two totally different animals, but at the same time, I mean, nowadays there are professionals that strictly do this backcountry type of a sport. There's a new event called Natural Selection, which is literally they're judging people riding down the natural terrain, hitting big airs, reading the terrain, picking your best line versus the half pipes, which nowadays are these perfectly sculpted, you know, regulation half pipes. When we were doing it, they were like, we would get to the contest 3 days early, not to practice, but to help dig the half pipe with shovels and shape the things. So that was what it was then versus now. It's evolved in a very different way in that regard. So again, it's two different animals, I would say, but the skill levels nowadays are mind-boggling from what
Same.
they're doing now versus what they did then. And it's inspiring and in some ways scary. Like, how big can it get? How big to the hat to the half pipe going to get, like, before they decide and say, hey, you know, one fall, you know, capping the top of the half pipe one time is a major hospital injury. At some point, some guys say now, and men and women that I know that are used to be pro, they're like, gosh, can't we bring back the little half pipes that were like only 10 feet tall instead of, you know, 20 foot walls, you know, things like that. So.
Let's get you out with this before we go local and then do 60 seconds more. What is the obsession? What's the drive? What's the whatever with extreme? And we could talk about a lot of sports, but there is this desire, there's just this, you know, burning whatever. People want the most extreme. And this, it probably goes beyond sports, but what is it? You've covered a lot of different things in the world. What is it? What drives people to go to the terrain that's never been touched, the half pipe that's higher than anything else? What is it? This crazy kid, I think he's from Northern Virginia, Claude, who won the world championship figure skating thing, and he does four of these, whatever those are. At some point, somebody's just going to implode, right? Somebody's going to try five, and he's going to implode. But what is the obsession with extreme in the broadest sense?
It's the feeling. It's like a drug. It really is. It's you know, it's a heroin. You drop into a very steep line in Alaska, there's nothing like it. And with fresh powder, it's like it's look at me, I'm speechless.
I
It's like
know.
flying. It's like flying. It's like, you know, collaborating with clouds on a steep mountain face, like that dream that you have where you can fly. That's kind of what it is. And you get to that at one point and you continue to chase it. But there is, you know, you can have a great adventure, especially snowboarding. Fresh powder, once you get to the point where you can plane above the snow and the board's intuitive under your feet, and it's a glide that you get. And as one of the guys I interviewed, one of the first people that went somewhere with Craig said, once you feel that feeling of that glide, when you're going just fast enough that your board planes above this smooth surface of velvet, that's it. You're done. You're a snowboarder for life. And I think it's really, at the end of the day, it's the feeling that what you have to be watch out for is that if you fall, will you die? And that is, and there are plenty of places where you can get a great adventure. And Craig really did believe in that. He was very careful in putting himself in places of exposure where if he did fall, he had his own little formulas for doing that. But again, you know, we know what happened to Craig, but he's still an amazing, I think, influencer, you know, of the time, and also just an inspiration to people, because at the end of the day, he was trying to learn to be safer when this occurred.
I think one of my favorite lines in the book, The Darkest White, was a photographer who said, if God's walked the earth, he was talking about Craig Kelly, just about his abilities, which is fantastic. Okay, Eric, as I said to you on this show, we love independent, we love everybody who reads all books, buy books, et cetera, but we love independent bookstores and public libraries. And we started this thing where authors chat up their favorite store, their favorite library, and then we make a donation. And you have one which sounded really special. You sent me an email earlier today, but talk about your favorite independent bookstore, at least for today. You can change it next week from today.
No, I will would say, well, first of all, they're disappearing at an alarming rate. My first book, the last season, there was a massive list, and I wrote individual letters to all of them. Now that same list is about a quarter that length of what it was in 2006. But whenever I go snowboarding to Mammoth, and I live in San Diego, I drive through Bishop, and Bishop on the east side of the Sierra has a little bookstore called Spellbinder Books. And Lynn Alameda supported me when my first book came out before anybody knew who I was. And it's got a little coffee house in back, and it's just an awesome bookstore that has survived for, you know, decades. And it continues to survive and has a great local clientele. And it's my always stop through when I drive through Bishop. So Lynn
Nice.
Alameda and the people at Spellbinder Books, they are awesome, and they're survivors.
Those who are survivors, I'll say there's a line, I'm sure I've stolen this from somebody, but in a complex world, we're seeking simplicity. Again, middle of books, right? Well, this is Pat, and I'm like you, I'll stop anywhere, any bookstore. And there's just a connection there, and there's a human connection there, and it's wonderful. So we'll support them. Okay, now we.
And I was going to say, when I go on a vacation, I would make it a point not to bring a book. I seek out a bookstore and I find the
Yes.
book I'm going to read on vacation.
That's a great idea.
It's a pro tip.
A
There you
good idea.
go.
Okay, Judd, you gotta at some point, Gaithersburg Book Festival, let's do something on independent bookstores. I realize it's a little functional and it's a topic, but you know, maybe we could just a couple of poets can, you know, take a pass for a year and we'll do. I think it's really important. I think it's really, really important.
I
Okay.
do too. I do too. I agree.
Hey, Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So, download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
The book is The Darkest White. It is fantastic. We've got a little bit of housekeeping here, so stay with us. And then we'll just say one more great thing about the book. Hey, everybody, we are back in 2 weeks with Susan Page, who is an icon. She's at the Gaithersburg Book Festival. We had her first Judd. She has known Susan for a long time. She has written so many wonderful books about truly iconic figures. And she's got one coming out. It's called The Rule Breaker. It's about Barbara Walters, who's a fascinating, fascinating character, and she's terrific. But in the meantime, when you're making your plans to go to the Gettysburg Book Festival, go to your favorite independent bookstore, go to your favorite local public library, where I'm sure you can get it, and get The Darkest White, A Mountain Legend, and The Avalanche That Took Him. Even if you're terrified of snow, as clearly Judd and Claude and I are, you will love this book. Claude, Judd, thank you. Eric, thank you so much. I mean, just a real pleasure and honor to meet you. And thank you for writing this terrific book. Everybody out there listening, thank you very much. And we'll see you in Gaithersburg in just a month, right?
May 18th.
May 18th. Somebody's
And maybe
birthday.
next year. Maybe
And have
next
fun.
year.
It'll
And
be May 17th next year. Put it on your calendar right now, Eric.
I'm
All right. All right.
envisioning fake
Nice to
snow.
meet
Eric, thanks very much. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks
Catch
for
you.
having me. Take care.
Great to meet you, Eric.
Likewise.